Thank you very much, Lynn.
It makes me tired just listening to all that stuff I do. You know, I hate it because I don't know. You know, as Lynn said, my beginnings were in La Leche League, and one thing happened after another, just kind of doing the things that I love, and I'm just so happy to see all of you here today. Thank you so much. I can't tell you how much your smiling faces and warmth and love just, you know, just make my world and really make me feel good, and thank you for your appreciation for Mothering Magazine. And thanks for getting up this early, for heaven's sakes, after the 4th of July. Is anyone tired? I thought, well, I think I can talk in my sleep, but I don't know how good I can talk in my sleep. You know, when we made up this topic, current topics or current trends and hot topics, it was when they start planning La Leche League, it's several years in advance, a couple years in advance. So I wanted to be able to talk about things that were more current. So this is the topic that we gave this talk. But as I was thinking about it, I thought it's really more what I want to talk about today is more sort of pulses and weaving and things that I see that are the kind of bigger trends of our time. I think right now we're, as a parent, it's essential that I stay optimistic, you know, that I stay hopeful about the world, and that I continue to craft a worldview that makes me feel hopeful, and I continue to look at things in a positive way. And you know, today in society, it's somewhat difficult to do that. There's a lot of things that we're afraid of, or that, you know, there's just a lot of fear in our culture, and fear is really runs opposite to the kind of love and openness and hopefulness that we need as parents, and that we need to cultivate. So I kind of want to talk about both smaller, you know, some of the issues that you expect me to cover from the magazine, but also kind of how this all fits into some bigger context, because I do think it is the job requirement of a parent to be optimistic. And I've been, as Lynn said, you know, I became a leader in 1975, so that's almost 30 years ago. And as you know, La Leche League has been around for 50 years, and almost 50 years. And what I see is that there are two parallel trends in society right now. There is, and I think what we're, you know, I think what we're going through is what's called a paradigm shift. And a paradigm shift is, a paradigm means the way that you look at the world. So if you go back in time when we used to think that the world was flat, that was a paradigm. That was the way it framed the way that we looked at the world. And then when we found out that the world was in fact round, it changed everything. In the last century, we've gone from Newtonian physics, which focuses on matter, to Einsteinian physics, which focuses on energy. So we're in the middle of a huge societal shift, and we're part of that shift, and the La Leche League is a huge motivator in that shift. And I think that shift is going from trusting outer authority to trusting inner authority, going from domination, a model of dominating, to a model of cooperation, a model of changing nature, to a model of changing ourselves. And don't you feel that pull and push inside yourself as you learn to parent in a new way, as you learn to trust your children? That's not always reflected for you in society, and it's difficult sometimes to keep your confidence about that, to trust that they will wean themselves, that they will sleep through the night eventually. That trust model is something that when we love our children in that way, when we follow the concepts of La Leche League, we find that that creates, in fact, a whole new reality, a whole new worldview for us. This group of people that are beginning to look at these ideas or the world in a new way is actually now has a name in psychology and in demographics. I don't know if you've heard this term, the cultural creatives. A man named Paul Ray did a study in the 90s, and he said that there's an emerging group of people in the culture. He called them the cultural creatives. And he said they're about 33% of the culture now. And they're people, I think, like ourselves, who value the environment, who are concerned about issues of family, concerned about women's issues, you know, wanting to buy things, but just get quality things or are wanting quality. So I think we're starting to define and articulate this new emerging group in the culture that I think was really originally or, you know, very strongly influenced by the vision and the real radical nature of the founding mothers of La Leche League, who started out many years ago to say, well, you know, we can do this thing. I fashioned Mother Magazine in the early days on what I knew as a leader. You know, we had our meetings and we got together and we went home and were with our kids and came back every month and had our La Leche League meetings. So when I started becoming involved in mothering, I did the same thing. That's what we did. We met once a week, went home and did our work and came back and did our business. So I learned in La Leche League a woman's way of doing business and a woman's way of being in the world that now has come to have a name, you know, and now we call it female management or women's management. But it's really the way that you do things in the home, the kind of intrinsic way. You're stirring the soup, you're on the phone, you're nursing the baby all at once. You know, that's kind of the way we've modeled our business, is still in that woman's way. We have children in the office, we have people working at home. We've tried to really materialize and have in our business the things that we talk about for others and that we idealize for others. So I think we see these two parallel threads in society now, and we see, I think, one old way dying and a new way being born. And it's often very difficult when we're involved in the kind of work we are in La Leche League of talking to people and giving them information and support to see this bigger picture, to see, like, you know, are things getting worse or are they getting better? You know, are we getting somewhere with this 50 years of work? And I'm here to tell you that we are. Because I don't think there's any better example, again, than La Leche League of this radical shift. Because La Leche League teaches you to trust your inner authority, to find an inner voice that you can trust your children's inner authority. La Leche League, in the concept about discipline, teaches you to cooperate rather than to dominate. And La Leche League, I think, what I learned in La Leche League is to change myself, rather than to change the other person or to change the world. You'll find if you don't have older children now that as your children get older, well, I think always from the moment they're born, they're such mirrors of us, aren't they? All the things that we don't like about ourselves, we can see in them, and then we wonder, how did they learn that? You know, why are you doing that? But I think, again, we learn from La Leche League and from this new model to change ourselves, to talk to them in a different way, to realize that they're reflecting our behavior and to continually try to be better models for our children, because it is through what they see that they really learn. But even after all the work of La Leche League, and even after this, you know, this, even as this new thread of awareness is erupting in our culture, we see a tightening of one of the signs of it, I think, is that we see a tightening of control in institutions, and we see a loss of faith in institutions, in government, in medicine, in law, in the church. We see in all those areas questions about these institutions. What are they? What, you know, what works for us? What works anymore? In medicine, I think we've seen an example of this tightening of control in the birth field, where you read press about the encouragement for women to ask for cesareans on demand. We printed a news piece in the last issue about the Coalition to Improve Maternity Services, a forum that they had in D.C. in March. And in that news piece, I reported that the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists supported elective cesareans, because that was what was I was reporting on what was said at the forum, and what I had come to believe was their policy because of the press that I was seeing encouraging elective cesareans. Well, I was pleased to find out that I got a letter from ACOG saying, this is not our policy. Where did you get that idea? I'm like, do you read the newspapers? So I, you know, wrote them back and I said, well, you know, we're happy to make a change, but we really, you do know that the public has gotten this impression that you're in favor of elective cesareans. And so they wrote back and said, well, no, you know, we aren't. As an organization, our president went on television and said that, but that was his opinion. And it was, you know, we didn't even know he was going to talk about it. And they wanted us to print an erratum, which we're going to in the next issue. And I said, I'm very happy to print that ACOG is not in favor of elective cesareans. But I think that that's a, what we see there is a kind of, as we see a tightening of control in that area of more intervention in reaction to the movements towards less intervention. I think this recent policy, of the vitamin D policy of the American Academy of Pediatrics, is another example of a policy that was presented as a universal recommendation. And people anymore don't really want universal recommendations. They really want to be able to know the evidence and make their own decisions. So, again, in communication with them, I felt it was important to say, you know, as parents, we would really like to know more about the risk factors and make our own decisions. I, for example, live in New Mexico. I wake up with the sun on me. You know, I can't get away from the sun. So that's a different kind of I'm in a different kind of a situation than other people might be regarding that. But again, I think we see these institutions sort of tightening up their control as they feel that they're losing it. In the government, I think we see a really strong example of this moving away from an outer authority in the vaccine issue. When I was a young parent in the 70s, it was unheard of to even question vaccinations because I came from kind of the back-to-the-land hippie movement of the 60s and was used to questioning about health. Or kind of that was what the beginnings of all that was. When I asked questions, nobody would even talk to me about it, and yet I just felt my questions were innocent and legitimate. Now we see in the last 5 to 10 years a really explosion of congressional hearings about vaccines, questions about vaccinations, and I think particularly this thimerosal issue, which is the mercury preservative that was in vaccinations really since the 30s and has just been taken out in the last few years, you know, that's really confused people and eroded their confidence in the authorities that approve and put the vaccinations out for us, that we realize that these authorities are not, you know, they're fallible as well, that they can make mistakes, that things can change. So it's not so much, you know, we don't talk about vaccinations in Mothering Magazine because we're opposed to vaccinations. We've always been for informed consent. We always try to cover issues that we don't feel are covered very much in the media in other ways. So that's been our philosophy in covering vaccinations. And as a journalist, I was shocked to find, going to some of these congressional hearings on vaccinations in Washington, that this information just simply wasn't getting to parents, that it wasn't being reported anywhere. And I felt like, shoot, I don't want to tell anybody this, you know, but I've got to tell them. It's my responsibility. And that's what I feel as a journalist, is my responsibility to share information. Even if this information in this case, you know, puts people in a decision, in a position where they are, it's very difficult because they really have to make their own decisions. And I think that's what many of us feel at this transitioning period. Kind of feel like, wouldn't we love to just rely on the authority? Wouldn't we love to just have the father figure tell us what to do? But on the other hand, we can't. You know, we have to be responsible to our children. And as I always think, you know, we're the only ones that live with the results of our decisions. 20 years from now, we'll still have our children, and many of the people that advised us, you know, we won't know them anymore. So it's so important to make those decisions deeply and consciously, because even when you do things later that you regret, you don't regret them when you really thought them through. You know, when you regret them is when you feel like, shoot, I wish I had known. I had no idea. You know, how could I have missed that? So that's where you tend to feel more regretful. It's not that you can always make all the right decisions, but just like in La Leche League, you know that so many of the things in this country that we consider choice are not really choice, because we don't really know the ramifications of our decisions. A woman is presented with the choice to breastfeed or formula feed as though they were equal, as though they were just another lifestyle choice, when in fact it's a health choice, much like you know, smoking or not smoking, very much like tobacco or something of that import, where it's not like, oh, I'm just going to smoke or not, and there's no information about the fact that, you know, one is much worse than the other. One thing that we've been coming in contact with in the magazine in the legal field, which is quite disturbing, but again, I think part of this tightening of authority in response to people choosing their own personal authority. Mothers who are, families who are separating and divorcing, in many cases, mothers or families who have strong opinions, particularly mothers who have strong opinions about vaccinations or breastfeeding, are sometimes being threatened with not getting custody of their children. What we're hearing I don't want to believe this is true, but we're hearing kind of a prejudice in the courts now towards women, in kind of a swinging back from the time when women got custody of children 100% to joint custody. There's kind of a bit of a favoring of fathers in the custody process that we're hearing about. And I think, in a way, because I think the courts or bureaucratic systems tend to favor the underdog or the one who's more helpless, and I think often the father is perceived as that way in situations in which there's underlying differences about practices, parenting practices. And what we've found over and over again in talking to people is it's just important not to, in separation and divorce situations, not to get into the court system, but to resolve differences through mediation, which can be done, and even with the help of, you know, you can have a lawyer to advise you, but if you can resolve things through mediation, you don't get in situations where things get out of your control. So if you know friends or you're in situations where there's separation or divorce, just be cautious about it. And we've got some resources now at the magazine of people we can refer people to about that issue. But that's another one where I feel there's sort of a tightening of control at the same time that there is a an expanding of choices among parents. There's a session today on HIV and breastfeeding, and that's one that's been kind of it first appeared to erode breastfeeding, because up until the HIV issue, it was pretty much, you know, breastfeed no matter what. And then when the HIV and AIDS issue over the last few years has, come into our culture, we have been told that HIV, women who test positive to HIV shouldn't breastfeed. Those of us who've been in La Leche League a long time thought, oh, I don't know, you know, somehow this doesn't make sense. It sounds like a lot of the old prohibitions to breastfeeding about other kinds of things. And is there more information we can find? Is there more evidence? It didn't seem to make sense that women would have to take really, really caustic and dangerous drugs, and not that wasn't weighed against the advantages and disadvantages of breastfeeding. Sure enough, we found in looking into it that as more women were being tested for HIV, like any test, as you know, during pregnancy, there's a certain amount of false positives. So if you have a test, for example, that's 99% specific, which means that 99% of the people will test correctly to the test, that means that still 1% will test falsely positive. Well, if you start testing all the women who are pregnant in the United States, which is about 4 million women a year, you've got about 40,000 women a year that could test positive to HIV falsely. There's a lot of other things that can affect a false positive when you're for HIV, and one of them is pregnancy. Pregnancy is one of the things that can create a false positive test. So we began to realize that, wait, these are women who, there could be some women who have no symptoms, who've been monogamous, who have no risk factors, and have tested positive. Could they have tested positive falsely? Could there be some variable here? Then Marian Thompson began to work with some researchers to try to find out more about, is HIV, you know, transmitted in breastfeeding? And in the research, and the woman's going to speak this afternoon, or I think at noon, no, at 10 to 12, about the research that she did and found, sure enough, that when they actually separated out exclusive breastfeeding from formula feeding and then from mixed feeding, they found that it was safe to breastfeed as long as you were exclusively feeding or exclusively formula feeding. So that the research that has, and the history that's been done in La Leche League on breastfeeding research, has really served the HIV or the community of moms who have tested falsely positive to HIV. And I put that out there as just another piece of information of things that don't always appear as they are, and I think are, again, this paradigm shift between a medical model that says, you know, this is how it is, you must do this, to one that gives you information and freedom of choice. Another place we see, I think, in these two sort of threads in our society is in the whole area of food. You know, in the United States, we have genetically engineered food that's not labeled, and that was only because of politics. Something like 90% of people wanted the genetically engineered food to be labeled, but industry prevailed and it wasn't labeled in this country. Internationally, however, as you know, the United States is trying to pressure Europe to use GE foods, and they have such a rich tradition of artisan foods and small dairies, small farms, that they, you know, they felt like that food, they weren't interested in it, and they felt like it might be a threat to the crops that they did have, and have been refusing it, so that I think on an international level we see again that that impulse to control, we must have this, and then people saying, no, you know, we want choice, we want to know what we're choosing. There's even been a slow food movement that's risen up. I don't know if you've heard of it, but starting in Italy, it's called Slow Food, and I love that name, and there are different groups and communities that are having events to just get together, and one of their goals is to bring back the table and the kitchen as a center of social life, you know, in the family and in life. So you see these, you know, even in the alternative energy field, or in the energy field, you see, like, you know, the Prius, these cars that are electric and gas coming. In New Mexico, our governor is promised to develop solar and alternative energy and wind energy. So you see this new sort of world bubbling up as this old world is stretching and yawning at some of its, some of its old ways. And parallel to this, again, this tightening of and control in some areas of society, again, is this growth and expression of personal authority. When the vitamin D issue came out, and I first heard about it a couple of years ago here at La Leche League, and, you know, we started working on an article about it. But in response, somewhat, not totally in response to that, but I was pleased to find out that when, you know, as that issue developed, that there were new resources in the communities of color to address this issue. There's the African American Breastfeeding Alliance that is working with this issue. There is a group on the, I believe they're on the internet, but I'm called the Muslim Mamas. I don't know if you've run into them, but they're a breastfeeding Muslim mother who are advocates for breastfeeding. Counter to the cesarean on demand that we hear in the news is the fact that midwifery is way up. In the 1970s, midwifery was down to about 1% of births. It's now up to almost 10% of births. In New Mexico, midwives attend 25% of births because we've had licensed midwives there since the 70s. So we're seeing a real huge growth in midwifery proportionately at the same time that we're seeing a tightening of the medical model in some areas. It's harder to get vaginal births after cesareans in some areas. So we're seeing both of those parallel threads. Again, in the vaccine issue, at the same time that we're hearing about more vaccines coming, we're also hearing about more vocal expression from vaccine advocates. Recently, right after the beginning of the year, there was has been in the Congress a bill being debated to change the vaccine injury compensation program, which was started in the 80s to compensate families whose children were injured by vaccinations. And in reviewing the compensation program, there was a lot of pressure from the vaccine industry to limit the amount of compensation that parents would get. And a huge group of vaccine safety advocates grew out of that, that have been able to work with the senators and the congresspeople to really try to ensure that parents, you know, if all parents are, all children are vaccinated, then all children should be protected from some, or receive some compensation. The smallpox issue helped to really articulate that, because in that issue, because it was for adults, many of the issues of liability and concern that parents had were echoed in that smallpox issue, like, well, what do we do if we get injured? Who will pay for that? What will happen if we miss work? Who has the liability? But a lot of those questions legitimized, or the smallpox questions legitimized, the questions that the parents had been asking. And again, not to say not vaccinate, but to say, let's make this a process rather than telling me what to do. Let me be involved in this process. Give me more information. Because, in fact, most parents want to vaccinate once they have information, but they often don't get that information, and again are surprised when things sometimes go wrong. You know, in the paper we've been reading about irradiated food in lunchrooms, at the same time that there's, again, this slow food movement, and many schools that are developing organic lunch programs are growing gardens in their schoolyards. So again, it's like we're building, you know, this new... You know, as you change from in yourself, from you change your habits or you change your lifestyle, you've got the one lifestyle going as the new one is being born. And again, that's what I see in society right now, these parallel threads that are growing. When I mentioned before the issues of mother's custody and HIV, what I see happening with mothers is very exciting. I think that we're really, Lynn mentioned that I had been, got involved with a group called the Motherhood Project a few years ago. And it's a group of women who've come together to really encourage the voices of mothers to be heard in the public conversation and to have those voices be heard strongly and legitimately. And when I first got involved in that, I was so excited to have, to feel, to, you know, just to hear that people were talking about motherhood in such a positive and powerful way. And over the last few years, I've been pleased to find out that there's a renaissance happening in motherhood, that there's something happening. I was, because I was involved in this group and we were talking about the possibility of a motherhood movement, Could we start a motherhood movement so that women's and mothers' voices would be heard in the public conversation? And I thought, well, you know, maybe we should start a newsletter called the Motherhood Movement. So I went on the internet, and there was already a group. It was called mothersmovement.org. I thought, oh my goodness, they're already doing this. Then I remembered this group that I knew in Sacramento called the Mother Support Network. They were, have been for about the last 11 years doing support groups in their community and now expanding those into support groups for others. There's a group called Mom. There's the Mom. There's a group called Mom, which is advocating for economic rights for mothers. There's a group called the National Association of Mother Centers on the Internet that will help you start mothers' groups. There's Moms Clubs on the Internet, which are for moms at home. There's MOCA, which is Moms of Color at Home. There's actually even a Center for Research into Motherhood at York University in Canada. And there's another group called Mothers Ought to Have Equal Rights. And just before Mother's Day this year, I was called by a group that started out in Boulder, Colorado, and was going to have a parade in Albuquerque called Mothers Acting Up. I love these names. And in the spirit of mothers, they do parades, not marches, wear funny hats, get on stilts, dress up in old clothes, an old kind of dresses, and they're trying to bring back the original idea of Mother's Day. And Mother's Day was actually started by Julia Ward Howe as a peace, it was started as a peace day to say, couldn't we just all get together as mothers from all nations and, you know, just stop this, you know, just work for peace and work against war. Can we, you know, how can we send our sons that we love and our daughters off to fight the sons and daughters that other people love? So Mother's Day was actually started as a peace day, and this Mothers Acting Up is working to kind of bring that back with a lot of humor. So I've just been delighted to find that all of a sudden, as if it seems, as though I turned around within 2 weeks and heard about all these groups that were proud to put mother in their name and that represented to me a mother's renaissance. Because we're talking about, you know, what we're used to in the world of mothers, I think, is groups around birth and parenting and breastfeeding. And even though we need more of those, it's exciting to see that there are the voices of mothers extending into the political arena, extending into the economic arena, to the environmental arena and the social arena, that, you know, we have something really so powerful to contribute as women and mothers from our perspective of giving and loving life, that our voices need to be heard in society. And many of us, you know, we don't feel, rightly so, that we have much time to do anything other than our family, and that's the way it should be. But occasionally we can join our voices with others to support things that we believe in. I think one of the things we see in these different threads in society is, again, this, you know, a movement of, you know, the dominating by the special interests when we want to talk about the needs and rights of families and children and what we need for a healthy society. So I'm encouraged that there's some of that going on, that there's more of that going on, that there's many organizations bubbling up to really express women's points of view. And I think that, you know, again, we're in a conservative time in society, but that if you look at that as a pattern in nature, you see that most times of expression in American society have been preceded by conservative times. The civil rights movement of the 60s was preceded by the 50s and the McCarthyism of those periods. The Dark Ages came before the Renaissance. In nature, you see that, in, you know, you have earthquakes in San Francisco. An earthquake is pressure. It's rubbing, and that rubbing precedes a very dramatic shift. In volcanoes, you see a pressure that precedes an explosion. You know that in your own life. You see that in the children. There's this pressure, and they have to blow up. They have to let off steam. So I think that's what we're seeing in society. We're sort of down in the trenches now. We're down bubbling things up, bubbling into an explosion of a lot of these ideas that we've been supporting in La Leche League for many years. I don't know if you've ever heard the hundredth monkey story, but there's a story that this man named Rupert Sheldrake that hypothesized something called the morphogenetic field. And he observed that monkeys on one island learned to wash their food, and that monkeys on another island who had never had contact with that first group of monkeys learned to wash their food some way without being in contact with them. So he hypothesized that once a certain number of monkeys or any species learns something, then it explodes exponentially into the population. So he called it the 100th monkey. Once the 100th monkey learned something, then all other monkeys genetically knew it. So I think that's how I see us. I see us as those monkeys. No offense. having a good time, swinging off the trees, and really creating a new model for society that we've been working at for a very long time, and that we don't even realize what pioneers we are, because we are doing it in our own lives. But the more we create, the more, you know how you, when you solve a problem in your own life that's really difficult, how it somehow makes it easier for others, it somehow creates, I think, a template for others. It somehow gives, I think we learn things from each other in ways that are indirect, as this Rupert Sheldrake talks about. And again, I've seen over the history of my involvement in birth and parenting that every time there was a move forward in birth or parenting or breastfeeding, it was always countered by some resistance. So as home birth got to be more popular in the 70s, there was a resolution by the American Medical Association against home birth. Right after that, some studies came out showing that home birth was safe. The birth center movement started to get popular at about that time, the end of the 70s, early 80s. We get in that time? Thank you. And at the time that the birth centers were popular, there was, again, a resolution made. I think it was by the, I'm not sure what the organization was, but a medical organization made a resolution against birth centers. Well, a few years later, there was studies showing how safe birth centers were. So I guess what I'm trying to say is it's normal for the status quo to resist change. We shouldn't take that to mean that change isn't good. In fact, we should take it to mean that change is good and that we're making progress. I think sometimes it's hard to keep perspective on social change when you've been working at something for a long time. And when you get involved in La Leche, you think, well, certainly I just have to tell people, and if I just give them this information, they'll just grab onto it and they'll change. And I thought with mothering, if I just spelled the words right and made it look pretty and people read it and thought that it was the way it was, that it would be the way it is. And in a way that's true, but you know, you realize that it just takes a lot longer than you think. And then in fact, in social change, an idea is first ignored, then ridiculed. No, first ignored, then ridiculed, then attacked, and then assimilated. So it's actually progress when somebody attacks your idea, because that means they're taking you seriously, right? If they just ignore you, then I'm with those crazy people. So you can see in the whole history of La Leche League that it's been a pivotal part of social change, and bears witness to how long it takes. But in fact, La Leche League, I think, has created a sea change in our society. And social change generally takes, for something to happen, about 100 years. It took 100 years for women to get the right to vote. It wasn't that it just happened in the 1900s. It was actually a 100-year movement. The Civil Rights Movement was a 100-year movement when kind of exploded into our awareness in the 50s and 60s. It had been going on for a long time before that. It took 100 years for us to move from lynching to jails. Public schooling took 100 years. So we're still in, you know, we're coming into the second half of this sea change that La Leche League has initiated in trusting ourselves and trusting our inner authority. And I think that we're going to see that just beginning to exponentially increase in the next 10 years. You know that healthy people, 2000, have goals for 75% in breastfeeding initiation rate. There's a ad council campaign coming out in October to support breastfeeding, so we'll actually start seeing ads in support of breastfeeding, and imagine how good that'll be. So I think it's important that we, as parents, look for signs of a positive future. And for me, because I have children who are adults, at every stage, it's like starting over again. When they entered their 20s, I thought, boy, this is like when they were little, and I was hoping that I was so happy when they all learned to swim, and I was like, okay, they can swim now, I don't have to worry about that. And I felt like in their 20s, it's the same thing, they were learning to swim in the big world, and I worried about, would they make it? You know, they weren't, they aren't doing things, they're doing things the way I thought they'd do them. They're being individuals. And three of my children in their 20s are still living at home. And we look at each other and we say, is this okay? Is this okay that we're such good friends with each other? Is it okay that we like each other so much? And yesterday I heard a presentation that I was so happy to hear, that in Latin America, children live with their parents until they marry and leave home. And that seemed to be sort of the normal thing that was evolving in our house. I mean, they come and they go and they, you know, they live on their own, but they kind of just are still coming and going. And I was on vacation with, and they still come and sit on my bed. My two girls would come and sit in my bed in the morning or when they're there. And we were on vacation, and we realized we were sitting sort of in the same relationship to each other that we did on my bed, where I'd sit here, and my one daughter would sit here, and my other daughter would sit there. And then we went over to my friend's house, who's also a long-time, whatever we call ourselves, La Leche League attachment parenting person. And we went out to dinner with a bunch of women, and then we ended up at my friend's house sitting on her bed. And then her kids came in, and they all jumped on the bed, and they were like little puppies. And I thought, this is really, we have really created a lifestyle here. We have really created a way of life that is expanding out to many other people. And that way of life is tangible. When I got to this conference, I talked to Kara Kohler, who's coordinating the event, and she said that both her daughter and her daughter-in-law were leaders. Then Marion Thompson showed me a photo of her second great-grandchild. This is fourth-generation natural birth. She said, she shows me this picture and says, oh, you know, and he was born at home, and it was all natural, and just sort of matter-of-fact. And I thought, this is the fourth generation of this, of people who have chosen natural birth and breastfeeding. I mean, this is starting to become a lifestyle. This is starting to become a culture. And that's what I see happening, is something very, very positive. People are asking really important questions, I think, about family, about community. This experience that we're having, that's what I want to say is talking about my adult children, is it just keeps on giving. The more that you give, the more you really respond to your children's legitimate needs, the more you learn to trust your own needs, and the better relationship you form, so that as adults, you're truly friends with your children in the best sense of the world, in the best sense of the word, and that you still have that intimacy and connection that that you have, you know, with your young children. One of the most popular discussion threads on our discussion boards at mothering.com is finding your tribe. You know, I find people writing articles about, where's my community? Where's my tribe? Where's my neighborhood? And our neighborhood anymore isn't necessarily where we live. You know, it's here in this room. It's when we come to these conferences, when we find our tribe, when we find our people that have the same values. And it's important that we trust those values, that we look for signs of a positive future. Because if we don't make it happen, who will? You know, if we don't create that future, who will? We talk sometimes a lot about what we don't like in society, but what does it look like when it's good? You know, we know what it feels like when we're here. There's so much love here. And when you go home from here, you just feel like you've had this huge drink of love, that you have so much to sustain you for a while, because you've really been with your people and you've been real and you've been connected and you've been touching and, all those things that are so important. I feel something coming to meet us from the future. I feel that there are fingers reaching out to meet us from the future, saying, come, come forward. The Hopi elders say that this isn't the 11th hour. This is the hour. The time is now. The river is running. Don't be afraid of it. Don't be afraid. We're in it. You know, we're moving forward to a bright future. There's a song that Johnny Clegg has called, he says, I saw the Berlin Wall fall. I saw Mandela walk free. I mean, did any of you ever think any of those things could happen? The changes that we've seen in our own lifetime. So don't be discouraged by conservative times or by resistance to change, but use that and take that as an indication actually of progress, that we are making progress. And use your experience with your children to make you look for a positive future and to align yourself with that positive future and believe in that future, because your children deserve no less than that. Thank you. I'd like to know what's on your mind, and if there's other things that I didn't talk about or things that I talked about that you'd like to comment on. Or do we have, is that mic working there, Lynn? Anyway, I think you can step up to that mic if you have any questions or comments. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Rebecca. I'm from France, and I'm a member. And I wanted to ask you, Peggy, if what kind of suggestions can you give me for France, who's very conservative? And anytime I ask the doctor, okay, what about this vaccine? He's just like, just do it. I do it to my kids, you know. And I was just curious what kind of suggestions you could give me of how to deal with that there, because it's we're legally obliged to vaccinate our children when they enter school, and so I'm just homeschooling him for now, but can't do that forever. So I don't know if I should fight, if I should sneak around, or who should I talk to? I don't know.
Well, is there, do you have, can you, are there any compatible or open-minded practitioners that you can find? Not somebody necessarily that isn't, that feels exactly as you do, but somebody that is tolerant of you making your own choices. Are there any?
I know someone who knows someone who found one.
Yeah, I think that's worth checking out, because I think sometimes it's like there are two, there's sort of two irreconcilable points of view about vaccinations. From a public health point of view, you know, you need to recommend that everyone's vaccinated. But from a parent's point of view, you're going to ask questions. You want to make an individual choice. So it's difficult to find a practitioner who's going to be that open-minded. But I think it's worth it to do that, because then you're not fighting that battle again all the time. And you're just, you know, you're with somebody who's going to be tolerant of your choices. So I think that's an important thing. I don't know. Do you have any, you'd have no exemptions in France or anything?
I guess if your child's allergic, or you could kind of push the allergy thing, you know, for several, you have to do it three times a year and keep on pushing, but I said it's not allergic to anything. I don't know.
Well, but you might, maybe you could explore that through it. Maybe there's a practitioner that you could explore if there's some options for medical exemptions based on even some of your concerns about that. And I think, again, it's always good to I know in our vaccination book, and if you come by our booth, I think there's resources in there for groups in other countries. I think there's something, there was at least something in France at one point, like a, you know, kind of a parent support group. So I think I might be able to find that for you.
Great, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
I personally attach my parent to daycare, and I've never heard, I'm not close enough.
No, just hold it, just move it up, yeah.
I personally do attachment parenting daycare, and I've never heard anything about that. And I don't know if there's any resources or if you've ever heard of anything like that, but I was just
I heard there's a wonderful program that some women were starting through the Waldorf School in Sacramento that was a daycare program that was inspired by Waldorf. And I'm going to have to ask you, Barbara, do you know about any attachment parenting resources for care outside the home? So do you, would you just stand up? So that's Barbara Nicholson from Attachment Parenting International. Maybe you guys could get together afterwards, and she'd give you the tips. And if you go on the, do you use the internet? So www.motherssupportnetwork.org would be a resource to find out about some the Waldorf resources for. You know, also, I got an email from a man named Michael Mendiza, who works with Joseph Chilton Pierce, and he's trying to develop resources for daycare. And if you email me, I'll give you his contact info. And my email is peggyo@mothering.com. Yes, ma'am.
Yes, I'm Bonnie Douglas. I'm a leader in Idaho. And I'm also a legislator, and I would encourage women to become politically active. It's the only way we're going to advance women's issues in this country. And even if you're not successful, I was not successful in getting the public breastfeeding, you know, bills through, and I wasn't successful in getting infant autopsies done when, you know, when babies die. And And I wasn't successful at all these things, but you raise the awareness and you break down some of the barriers. So we have a very poor voting rate in this country. I think it was like 20-some percent of the people vote. And so if we want to raise our issues, we need to start making sure that our friends who think the way we do are voting and are electing people who support our agendas. And I think there's a lot of political power that hasn't been tapped within this organization. And I do want to ask a question. What do you think that La Leche can do to get more... it seems like we've been labeled as a middle class and upper class, and we don't appeal to women of color as much as we should in the United States. And do you have any suggestions culturally for our organization to advance, getting our message across to lower income and women of color?
You know, I don't know if I asked that same question in the magazine. You know, I feel like the magazine doesn't reflect the diversity of our readers, the diversity of our population. I'm not sure that it's our fault when it doesn't. I think that it's making liaisons with groups that are established in underserved communities or in communities of color, whatever it is. I think that that's, I'm almost thinking that I went to New Zealand, and in New Zealand there's the Maori tribe, you know, the Maori people, and they were very insistent that they didn't want to join in with the New Zealand Midwifery Association. They wanted to have their own Maori Midwifery Association and then collaborate with them. So I don't know that we can be any diverse, more diverse. I don't know that we can reach out. That's what I thought in the magazine. I thought if I just, you know, have more diverse photos and more of an appearance of diversity, that would be diversity. But I thought it doesn't work that way. We have to build it. And I think we're doing that in La Leche, like through the peer counseling programs. I don't know.
I have a question on that. Same thing. Do you think that part of it is that maybe in the low income you can't afford to be a stay-at-home mom because you're working part-time jobs at minimum wage, you know, in the family, and so there's more social pressure to work when your income levels are lower. If you have one person who's making higher income, it's easier for the mother to stay home with the child. I'm just
sure. Yeah, I'm sure that those economic issues are a hard part of it, a huge part of it. I think that a lot of people don't, you know, necessarily have the leisure or the history, or that maybe meetings aren't meaningful in the same way. I know in the African American culture too that many of the things, like for example, breastfeeding is associated with wet nursing and slavery. So there's particular issues that are unique to each culture. So I think that each subculture and group in our country has to find their own support. I'm not sure that people. I think that really we are still in many ways a very segregated culture, and that this is that what it's not. That we're doing anything. It's just that we're reflecting that segregation. I'm not sure that, again, communities of color would come into this organization as much as they would come into their own organizations and then collaborate with this organization. But I think we should still be continuing to ask that question. And I think we should ask it very openly. Like, what is going on? Are there any people of color in this room? Yeah, see, so I always ask that question to myself, too, and I don't know what the answer is, but I think we should keep asking that question and reaching out. There is now, as I mentioned, an African-American Breastfeeding Alliance, and I really want to facilitate, you know, their growth and their interaction with La Leche League, so maybe it's identifying that, those groups. And I wanted to echo what you said about political involvement, because I used to think, and I still do, I think that being a mother, being an active, committed parent is the best social activism that you'll ever do, and is plenty. But like I used to think that if we just spelled everything right, like I said, and presented it, people would change. And it's been disheartening to find, you know, how much money influences the political process. And this group that I'm on the board of, Commercial Alert, launched the Parents' Bill of Rights, which we had an article of, and went to Washington to try to get support for this. And we're told time and time again that if somebody supported their bill, which was against industry, that senator or congressman congressperson would have to raise $1 million to fight the money that would be raised against them. So these issues that we think as parents, doesn't everyone want these things for families? There just isn't the political will for that. And I agree with you that we are the ones, as the women and the mothers, that must be that voice for that political will. Even if we simply make sure that we're registered to vote and that one other person is registered to vote, particularly the young people, particularly the ones in their 20s and the new voters, so, or maybe 10 people. You know, I think we've got to realize, I feel exactly the same way, that we are this huge political force as women and mothers, and we have very many things in common, and we don't have to have everything in common. You know, at this Mothers Acting Up march or parade that I went to, there were people, it was so cute because it was mothers acting up, and these people came into the parade, and they were carrying anti-abortion signs, and they thought, well, this is the perfect place to have these signs, you know, pro-life. And then other people in the group said, well, you know, we really weren't going to do that issue. We aren't all in agreement on that issue. And I felt it doesn't matter. You know, we don't have to agree on everything. There are plenty of things we agree on. In this Motherhood Council, we're making wonderful alliances with women who, you know, other would label conservative, but we feel like we totally agree on issues about motherhood. So I think we've got to get rid of some of these barriers and boundaries, these petty things, and find inspiration in this Julia Ward Howe and her vision and how we can come together as women in our culture and with other cultures to support, agendas that are for families. And so many of these words have been co-opted, you know, family values and all these things. You don't know what they mean anymore, but don't worry about it. Don't be afraid of that. Just try to talk about them openly and honestly and to try to make change. Yes, ma'am.
Hi.
Hi.
I would like to know what I can do about public school. I've got a 5-year-old that's going to be there next year. So many of my La Leche League friends, me included, have opted for homeschooling or Montessori school, and it's because some of the things that disturb me about our public school, for one thing, you have to be vaccinated. For another, after PE, you get sugary treats. There's some things that bother me, but I'm for public school because if we don't support public school, then only the children of wealthy, educated mothers are going to, we're going to have a class system. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to know what I can do in my neighborhood and what I should do my own self with my public school choice.
That's a very good question, because on the one hand, you want to protect your child and should, and on the other hand, you don't want to live an isolated life with your child, and you don't want to feel like you're dropping out of society. You want to participate. But I think it's important to keep, it's like keeping a paradox that both those things are true. You may not be able to change things quickly enough to serve your child, so you may need to do what you feel in good conscience is appropriate there. But are there any efforts you can make to improve the school, to get involved in the school, to get on the school board? Or, you know, we think that who are those people out there doing those things? We should work, you know, there are a lot of those positions that need our help. So I would look in your community. Is there a particular school that you would identify as a potential public school that your child might go to? I mean, are there more than one, or is there?
Well, we have lots of public schools, but there's one just 2 blocks from my house, which I would love to go to, but I went to kindergarten roundup and I was faced with all this stuff, and we'd been in Montessori preschool, and it makes Montessori look pretty darn good, yeah. I hate to say. So I do think you're right that mothers who have the time and energy to get involved, instead of pouring myself into Montessori, I should probably try to pour myself into
the public. No, I'm not suggesting that. No, because I think it's like you got to take on, you know, how much can you take on? But I would at least... See, then I think it's also, maybe you don't do public school in those early years because that doesn't work, but maybe as your child gets older, in the older grades, it might work for your child. He or she, is it he?
Yes, it's a he.
Yeah, so he may, you know, and he may say, gee, I want to go. Like my kids, we did everything, homeschooling, alternative schooling, public schooling. And, you know, sometimes my kids just wanted to go to that school, and that seemed appropriate. And they wanted to hang out with their friends, and you know, so So I would temper, I don't think you have to feel that you have to save that school and get your kid, your child in there, but I would start to have some kind of relationship with it. See if you can, because there's probably more than meets the eye there. There's probably good teachers as well as teachers that maybe you're not so crazy about. And I know you know, there's just start getting to know it. I think start with taking that strange thing and just getting more comfortable with it.
Thank you.
What time? How are we doing on time? Where are we?
We have 20 minutes.
All right, good. Oh, are you back? Hi.
Yeah. Hi. I'm wondering how you feel elimination training fits in with these trends you're talking about. And has there been or will there ever be an article about it in Mothering?
There has been an article about elimination. Do you know what elimination timing is, you guys? It's when you, and forgive me if I don't explain it correctly if somebody else knows more, it's when you don't use diapers, but you try to determine when your child's going to go to the bathroom, and then you hold them over the bathroom or outside. We did an article about it in the 80s. And it was a story of elimination, or a woman who had lived in China and how it was used in China. And we've gotten some articles about it now, but they've been more like advertisements for it. They haven't talked, I think, as broadly as I like to talk about the issue. I have some questions about it myself. In my generation, when I grew up, babies were toilet trained really early, and what I thought and what I believe is that if you toilet train babies too early, it can contribute to obsessive compulsive behavior. So if I want to cover this topic, I want to make sure that we address the question of how elimination timing is the same or different than too early toilet training. And I know that it has to do with being aware of the child's subtle signs, and I appreciate that, but I guess I just have some questions about it myself that I haven't been able to resolve, so I don't know if I would consider it part of the trend, because I haven't quite figured out what, if it's parent-centered or child-centered, I guess. I don't quite know. And I think it's probably all those things and used differently by people, I think I have some prejudices about it. Hello.
Hi, I'm Laura Lay from California, and I need some ideas and about how to advocate for children's rights in general. I had a couple of bad experiences. My 10-year-old son went in and bought a mouse pad, and then he decided...
Bought a mouse pad?
Yeah. And an hour later, he decided he wanted to return it. So we went into the same store, and they wouldn't give him his cash paid back because he didn't have an ID card. Was there a policy? Because it was a big corporate chain, and they probably, had security guards on their cash registers to protect them from employee theft. I don't know. I'm just guessing. But a big, big corporate thing, and... that was one instance. Another instance was he went into the credit union to try to make a deposit into his own account, tried to put money into his own account. They wouldn't let him because he didn't have an ID.
And he's 10. Did you say he's 10?
He's 10.
Are really kids expected to have IDs at 10?
Well, that was my question. I said, how many 10-year-olds do you know? I try to encourage my children to be autonomous, so I send them into the grocery store, and they've been real successful, going in and purchasing things. But these two instances just really, my 10-year-old just came out so deflated because he didn't have the power over his own, money or... And it was very discouraging. So I want to get into a movement or take some action to ensure that kids have more rights and power over their own lives, because every week in the paper you're seeing an editorial about how kids don't take responsibility and complaining about how badly they do in the world, and here we are trying to give them that authority and responsibility, and they're shut down. You know?
Well, I think you've already made huge progress, though. I mean, I used to find with my kids that they wouldn't even see them sometimes. I mean, they'd go up to the counter, and they would not acknowledge that they were there, you know? So part of that is okay, because it's good for your son to see how it really is. I think I would go back into those establishments, because we tend again to make it into this, like, the big corporate thing, right? Because we're the things we're afraid of and angry about. But it's really just one person in that place using that policy. So I wonder if you could have a conversation with the manager, with your son present.
I did.
And?
I asked for the manager. I talked to them, and she just said, oh, it's just, we can't even, you know, it's the cash register, and it's our policy, and you know.
So is it the ID that's the question? Could we make him an ID? I mean,
well, I could go that way. I could go to the DMV and get him an ID made up, and well, he has a passport now. I suppose he could use that.
Oh, he could take his passport. Yeah, there you go.
But a part of me says, you know, what about, you know, the 99% of kids who don't have an ID or a passport?
And you don't want to go into that. All right, how about you shop at places that don't treat you like
that? Well, definitely. I'll never go back to that computer store again.
So I think you do what you do. You go, you communicate, and then you say, I'm taking, and then you let your dollar, right, speak for you. I'm going to shop at the places. And I think anymore there's a movement in Santa Fe. It's called... oh, I don't know, something about business, but it gives you coupons of different businesses, you know, that to support local businesses, like instead of getting stuff at a big chain, you know, where's this place that this money will stay in the community? How will my money stay in this community? How can I support that? And that's challenging, because a lot of times the chains are so cheap, much cheaper, that, we really choose for price. But often when things are cheaper, it's because somebody didn't get paid enough. So I think try to be responsible to the place, tell them your truth, and then if there's not reconciliation, then I wouldn't take my business there anymore. I don't think there's more you can do. I mean, you could write a letter, and then and again, I think as you said, Betty, was it? The legislator? Bonnie, the B. Bonnie. As Bonnie said, you know, and that was very inspiring, that it doesn't necessarily mean if you're successful is not the only measure of success. I mean, that something changed, but that you raised awareness. So certainly by talking to the people, you raised awareness, and maybe if it doesn't change right now, it will change eventually. You see that with the breastfeeding in public, where things will happen and the people will actually change it. Maybe right then they're too embarrassed, but then over time they talk to each other and figure it out. But I'm like you, I don't want to go to Let's All Have IDs for Children. What does that say to them? You know, they don't need that. Let them go to a store where they know who they are and they know their name, you know. A big letter to them. Yeah, we got the talking the letter. Yeah, you don't even want... I scare my kids' teachers, you know. One joined the Peace Corps after we talked to her. It's like, you won't be talking to my daughter like that. Yes, sir.
Yes, I'd like to contribute something in response to the two previous ladies. And actually, we are just now opening a very different school in Marin County. It's a Sudbury school. And and a Mothering magazine has written about Sudbury schools, I believe, in the November 2000 issue. It's an article by Daniel Greenberg. Sudbury schools are schools where students determine entirely what they want to do all day long, every day. And the school is democratically governed by students and staff. And I just want to say, too, how much I appreciate your encouragement going with an unconventional idea again in a traditional environment. And, I just wanted to remind everyone that there are alternatives out there. And
just to look for them, yeah. And so he's talking about the Sudbury schools, which are called democratic schools, isn't that correct?
Yes.
And it was started, there's one school back east, and now there's more, but they're kind of almost in the Summerhill model, but a model of where the child does get to decide and direct their learning themselves.
Yep. Yeah, one of the major differences to Summerhill is the involvement of parents.
Okay.
So while Summerhill is in general
against
parents' involvement at Sudbury schools, the students decide themselves how much parent involvement they want.
Okay. So the students decide. Thank you. So I think that's a good point. So I always find, like, people say, I don't know anyone in my neighborhood. I don't know, you know, and then you'll find there's somebody a few blocks away or something. Just keep looking and asking people. And you, the woman in the red over there, you had a question, did you? Okay, thank you. Thank you.
This may not apply to anybody else, but I have my own question. I'm a military wife, mm-hmm. and I live in a military community, and I feel like I'm the only one that parents this way at all. Any suggestions, resources, anything? Because
I've met a number of military moms, though, parenting like you. Maybe you need a support group for military moms.
Yeah.
I'm a military brat myself. My dad was in the Air Force, so I know that moving around, that's something, you know. And just right now, with you don't have anybody over in the...
Yes, I do. My husband's in the Gulf right now.
Oh, our thoughts are with you, our prayers, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I wonder if you just couldn't put that out in league. Couldn't you put out a league to try to find a support group for... Because, boy, even if you can't get it in your local area,
yeah.
maybe you could... Do you use the Internet?
Yes.
Yeah, so maybe you could get it through there. Because I really, at this conference, I met two other moms. We had an article a long time ago about a woman who was in the military herself and was trying to... you know, do parenting in a good way. So,
in Spokane, Washington, the Fairchild Air Force Base has a La Leche group. And that might be something that they might even have a website. I'm not sure. But it's Spokane, Washington, Fairchild Air Force Base, and it has a La Leche group.
And where are you?
Where's in San Diego.
You're in San Diego.
I am a leader of my group. And we do get some moms, but, I mean, I'm talking more like up in my actual housing community and stuff like that, where I'm looked at like a complete freak because...
Were you what? Would you repeat that? What?
I said I feel like a complete freak in my military community in the housing that I'm in. Mm-hmm. I'm the only one, I swear, that does anything outside the mainstream, so...
You're going to have to find at least one convert in your neighborhood and corrupt her and make her your friend.
Yes, thank you.
But maybe get together with Bonnie afterwards if you can give her any contact for that. How are we doing? What time is it?
8 minutes.
Okay.
A lot of moms have made comments about their homeschooling because that's how they can avoid the vaccination issue. And now I'm just educating myself now about vaccination, but from one thing that I've learned is that if, God forbid, there's a tragedy and your child ends up in the ER, the first thing they ask is your child caught up on their vaccinations? And if there's not, they will give them the vaccinations right then and there. One suggestion that I was told by a doctor was if you have a doctor who will support your decision to not vaccinate, then your response to the ER team can be something along the lines of our doctor says he's fine, or he's fine with our doctor, or put it on the doctor's shoulders, and then sometimes they'll let the kids go. But I just want you to be prepared in case something awful does happen. That might still be an issue for you.
I think you can say something really simple like that. Again, it's really a lot of those situations when you come upon them, they scare you, but they're just between you and that person. It's not bigger than that. So you can say something, yeah, it's all fine, or that's all taken care of, or something referring to another person. And that generally, I think that would be sufficient as well. Because again, you're taking responsibility for that and saying, yeah, we've taken care of that. That's all fine. So I think. Can say something like that too. Yes?
Again, you need to seek out your own support.
Could you repeat that?
You need to seek out your own support in a lot of these issues. As far as vaccination in the public schools, there's a form you can sign to allow your child to still go to school, even though, or if you haven't vaccinated, if you've signed the form to waive that. And also, La Leche League has an attachment parenting online for public school parents. or parents whose children are in public schools. So again,
did you say attachment parenting online for?
Well, I forget the exact title, but it's attachment parenting. I think it's just all it's called, but it's for parents with children in public schools that are still practicing the attachment parenting.
Okay.
So to get that reinforcement and support, even though they're in a different venue.
Right. And, you know, I think there are about half states that have philosophical exemptions. All states have medical exemptions. Most have religious, and about half of them have philosophical. In New Mexico, you can simply sign a paper, and then that is used in lieu of your vaccination records and brought to the school, because the school's legal obligation is to have on record either your vaccination records or an exemption. So that fulfills their requirement, and you can call your local public health department and they can tell you how that works in your state, or in the back of our vaccination book we have all the states listed and what their exemptions are. And I think, again, yeah, look, there are more. Attachment Parenting International has support groups. There's Families for Natural Living. There is, I mentioned, these Moms Club Mother Centers. There's a lots of way that you can continue to get support around the issues that face you as your children get older. Any other questions about some of these, you know, grittier issues that I just kind of touched on that we talk about in the magazine, just things that you're worried about or...
Hi, Peggy. Hey, I'm from Wisconsin, and Wisconsin is now pushing. I'm a VBAC candidate,
a VBAC candidate. I see. Let me see. Let me apply for a VBAC.
Wisconsin is now really pushing that you're not even going to have a choice in the hospital anymore. That your physician is going to have to monitor you himself for your entire labor. And I'm just wondering if you have any ideas.
Monitor if you're choosing a VBAC?
Yes, if you decide that you want to have a VBAC in the hospital, your physician will have to monitor you, be with you the whole time. And my physician is saying, you know, that's really impossible. I have a practice that, you know, I have other patients and... that I have to attend to. So, you know, my choice is, home birth, which I am open to, but, you know, for other women out there, I know there's several in our La Leche League group that are, have just had their first babies and they're like, you know, really devastated because they had to have a C-section and their doctor is now like, well, now you're just going to have C-section after C-section. I'm just wondering if you have any ideas.
I'm very upset by that trend. I can't, you know, there's, and yet I'm hearing different things. We heard that, I don't know, in Washington State they had totally outlawed VBACs, and then we heard, no, that wasn't true, that was just one practice or something. So I'm not sure what the protocol is. I don't know if anyone can fill us in why there's been this change, because generally the VBAC guidelines were always related to how many minutes it was to how many minutes it was to anesthesia, you know, if you needed a cesarean. But I guess my first suggestion is, is that all the only choices you have is that doctor?
Well,
even if you say you don't choose a home birth, are there any other doctors that would be?
I don't think so. I mean, he is a fantastic, I have had a VBAC, but I'm saying for my subsequent births, he's saying I don't know if I can do it because of all the backlash that he's getting. I mean, he got a backlash from my last child because he let me go 16 hours before he broke my water. And the hospital really gave him a hard time, the nurses, everything. So he is fabulous. I mean, I recommend women to him constantly because he seems like he's the only one in our area that even lets women go 43 weeks, lets them, you know, make their own choices, and he'll support that.
But see, I hate that language. I'm sorry. I hate that language. Lets them. Why does somebody get to let us? You know, so how can you change the thing? I think we can't put up with this. We can't say, okay, I'm going to compromise because you're almost okay. I mean, I feel like I would go anywhere to get the birth that I wanted because everything starts from that and everything is dependent on that. So if you have to travel somewhere, I mean, I would fight for that birth. I would fight for somebody to be at your VBAC. And even if you like this person and he has good qualities, you know, I want somebody to go further with me. I don't want to feel that, because if you feel that you're operating with somebody who is conditional with you in your birth, then, you know, that doesn't give you the confidence you need.
What do you feel is the next step to take to...
I think I would really, I mean, and maybe I would find, where's the midwives in your community? I would really try to find out what city do you live in
Wisconsin? We live around Milwaukee.
I mean, what about you go to Chicago and go to, I mean, they have that whole birth first thing in Chicago with Dr. Eisenstein. Do you know him? What's it called? No, home birth?
Yes.
They have all these home birth places right in Chicago. I wonder if, because they give you a little bit of that more medical model with the VBAC that you might want, but it still has the home birth. I'd call their office. I'd say, do you know anybody up here who's, you know, doing this? Or is there anyone in between here and Chicago that I can find that's maybe a little bit more open? I'd just keep asking questions and find where the underground scene is, because there's got to be something going on.
I don't necessarily feel like it's the doctors. I think it's more the hospital administration.
I think it might be that too, but I will try to track down the politics of that, and we will cover that. But so maybe in digging into it, you can find out more if there's anything you can change in that regard. And do you have something to comment on that?
Well, what about direct action?
Direct action. There we go.
You know, I know it's hard to take direct action when you're in labor, but just keep saying no. Well, no, I don't want my water broken. Well, no, okay, I'll sign against medical advice. No, I don't want that. No, I don't want a C-section. No, I don't, you know.
Yeah, the showing up at the hospital late. There's always
unfortunately, even though there's been a call for the lessening of amount of cesarean sections, I'm from Maryland, and there's many women who have found that birth centers will no longer support VBACs, and it's not because they don't want to, it's because their supporting hospitals will not let them, and they will lose their supporting hospitals, and the supporting hospitals don't want to do it because of malpractice insurance and because of the high cost.
Something just changed. What was it that changed this?
I don't know if it's that people have sued. Oh, he knows.
Hi, John Assyrian, pediatrician from Chico, north of
New
York.
Thanks, John.
Yeah. What changed is that I think the American Academy of OBGYN had a policy statement. It basically is the availability of anesthesia. And I know we went through this in my hospital.
That's what it is. Immediately available?
They have to be basically immediately available. And in my hospital, we couldn't get the anesthesiologist to do that. So in a big hospital that has, you know, like a medical school or a teaching hospital, it has anesthesiologists or anesthesia residents, they can do it. But the smaller community hospitals where somebody has to get called in from home, it's impossible. And we had five women that, in our hospital, the change came on July 1st, and they had five women that we had just had to deal with that were due in June, and anesthesia just refused. And so it's just a whole geopolitical kind of thing, and the OBGYNs are just taking too big a chance. In our hospital, I think what we finally decided, if a mother came in and just, you know, signed a waiver that they, you know, relieved everybody of their liability in case something happened, then that covers the doctor. So you have to cut. That's one alternative.
And is that, it used to be that the anesthesia had to be, within 15 minutes or half an hour or something so that somebody could be called in?
Yeah, I'm not sure what it was, but now that it's the standard of ACOG, everybody has to kind of fall in place, or it's just, you know, they're hanging out there too much.
Okay, thank you for that information.
Excuse me one moment. This session is officially over. We can continue in this room for a few minutes and go on with our discussion. But first, I would like to thank everyone for attending and thank Peggy for sharing her thoughts on these topics.
Let's just finish a couple more questions.
I just wanted to add, we're having the same problem in Connecticut, and actually the birth center where I delivered my daughter, I've had all natural, luckily, they just had to stop doing VBACs too, and for them it's more because the hospital won't cover the insurance, and Connecticut's having a big problem with all their doctors for their medical insurance, their own liability. They've been doing their own rallies at our state house. Because it's so expensive, they can't afford it. Doctors are leaving Connecticut because it's cheaper to go somewhere else. And I think that's part of it in our state, and they're just saying that VBACs are too risky.
for the liability.
That's, you know, it's just going to skyrocket the cesarean rate, which is already way too high. That's crazy. And I think that's part of that same paradigm shift. It's like that whole system is, what are they, crazy? They can't go in that direction. I mean, we're never going to put up with that. Right. So we'll have to figure out something to do about this, and I'm not sure what yet. Yes, ma'am.
On the tail end of that, I have a question, and I also just wanted to say, having a birth plan, I think, for us made a huge difference, because I was able to talk to the doctor about it ahead of time, get him to sign off on a whole bunch of different things that were important to us, and then when it came time for delivery and they were trying to do all these different things, I could say, you know what? Sorry, my doctor has already said that this is fine with him, and, you know, then I had the okay to call my doctor if anything happened. And the other thing I wanted to ask about was, is there anything new and upcoming? I actually live in Saudi Arabia, and so a lot of the things that people are talking about, I don't really have a part of. But I was wondering about water births and the safety of, there is a possibility that you might have a water birth at home. I was wondering how safe that is, or is it completely unsafe, like if you were in your bathtub? I'm just wondering. I don't know.
Is it completely unsafe? I think water births can be totally safe. A lot of people are choosing water births. People get certain tubs. I don't know if you have to...
Yeah, see, that's the thing I'm saying. I'm saying
I don't think it has to be in a certain place. I mean, in a certain kind of a tub. I don't think it has to be in one of those things. It's just because of the size of them, I think. There's a website. Do you use the web?
Yes, I do.
There's a website, Barbara Harper. What is it called? Water birth. Just go on the web under water birth. Try to find Barbara Harper. She's got the whole water birth thing. Or if you want to, I can give you that. I think I can get you her information.
Okay, thanks.
Oh, yeah, I was supposed to tell you a couple things. There's going to be a tandem nursing session from 3 to 4:30 this afternoon in Union Square 12, which is on Building 3, fourth floor. And Mother is going to have a reception tonight from 8 to 9:30 in... In the presidential suite, which is 14178, and I'd love everybody to come if you aren't sleeping by then. So 8 to 9:30, room 14178, and email me if we didn't cover everything, and thank you very much. Bye.